Many people don't realise that Australia is among the top three takers of refugees for permanent resettlement in the world. That's, of course, a different thing from countries that have hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people flowing through their countries, fleeing from other places, but not necessarily wanting to or being able to resettle there. And what happens is very large camps are set up with tens of thousands of people, and people almost treat that as if that is the solution. We've looked after these people. But in fact, we really do need to do more than that. Just put people in a camp and leave them there until another country can take them. Usually not. My next guest is Alexander Betts. He's Professor of Forced Migration and International Affairs at the University of Oxford and author of a new book, Refuge: Transforming a Broken Refugee System. He's got some ideas on how to fix parts of this system, and he joins me now in the Adelaide studio. Professor, welcome to Counterpoint.
Great to join you.
Well, there are camps around the world, aren't there, that have got thousands of people. What's the largest one that you know of?
I think we need to be very clear that the majority of the world's refugees are in developing regions of the world, around 90%. And the default response is to set up camps. Many of them become extremely large. For instance, in the north of Kenya, the Dadaab camps house 350,000 Somalis. And of those 350,000, 100,000 have actually been born in those camps, because the camps have been there since 1992, and some of the Somalis have been there all of that time. So people are being born into, growing up in, becoming adults in those camps. And the tragedy is, very often they're not allowed to work, they're not allowed freedom of movement, educational opportunities are limited, so we're warehousing people. And it's a tragic waste of humanity, a waste of talent, and we leave people in limbo.
It's a terrible term, isn't it, warehousing people, but it's the perfect description of what happens. Now, there are camps in Jordan too, aren't there, that are very sizable. How big would they be?
Well, the Zaatari camp, the most famous in Jordan, houses 83,000 people. There's another large camp called Azraq that hosts around 40,000 Syrian refugees. Jordan hosts about 650,000 refugees. Most are actually in urban or peri-urban areas. And that's because camp life is so desolate with so few prospects that refugees from Syria are increasingly bypassing the camps, but they don't end up much better off, because in urban areas, it's only the most vulnerable of the vulnerable who get any assistance. They traditionally haven't been able to work. Work permits are very expensive. So they've really got a choice between camps and potential urban destitution.
I've been to one camp in northern Thailand. It escapes me at the moment how many people were there, but there were tens of thousands for the Karen. There were grandchildren being born there whose parents had spent their entire life there. Maybe the grandparents arrived as children. And I can't help but think, gee, the more people we can, Australia can take from these camps, the better. Now, when you mention these camps, I'm sure people think of plastic tents or, you know, canvas tents, whatever. Cities, I mean, 350,000 people. Imagine the problems with bedding, sewage, cooking, being able to buy food. It's a logistical nightmare. What could we do to make this better?
Well, these camps are almost de facto cities. They're of the size and scale. They become semi-permanent. But most of the host countries don't want to acknowledge their permanence. They want people to eventually go home. So we end up with structures that are intended to be temporary, that might work for the emergency phase to provide food, clothing, shelter, and they endure over time. The example you gave of the Thai-Burmese border, there's a community there that's self-governing, self-sustaining, but there are huge restrictions on what refugees can do.
They're not free.
They're not free. No. And the biggest restriction is they usually can't work.
Yeah.
Now, if you can't work, you can't use and develop your skills. You're not getting vocational training. And so you stagnate. And that's bad for the host country because they don't benefit from entrepreneurship, taxpayers. It's bad for the country of origin because when countries like Iraq or Syria return to peace, they're going to need human capital. They're going to need skills and talents for those people that go back. So the real key to transforming this is to empower refugees to have the right to work. Jobs are central to this. If refugees are going to be self-sufficient, help themselves, help the community, not be indefinitely dependent upon aid and humanitarian assistance, we need to reconceive this whole paradigm as not just a humanitarian response, but a development response, one that benefits refugees and host communities.
Okay. Now, you say jobs. I understand that. But having been the immigration minister in the past, I can also understand that as soon as you say we're upping the immigration intake, fine for me and what we call the sort of doctor's wives. Apparently this is a pejorative term for people in safe Liberal or Labor seats who've got good incomes, who just want to be seen to be doing good things. people on lower incomes say, look, it's all right for you, sport, but my son could lose his job. People do worry about jobs. Now, how can we work to make sure those people who are not the most advantaged in developed countries feel secure in allowing a big influx of people in who might then want jobs?
A good refugee policy has to also be a good host community policy. Mm-hmm. It has to be that whether it's in the developing world or the developed world, mm-hmm. we provide additional benefits in terms of investment in jobs, in terms of public services like education and health for the host community. So they all benefit alongside one another. Otherwise, you'll get animosity and tension. But what we've seen in developing countries is when refugees are given the right to work, everyone benefits. So we've done research, particularly in Uganda, a country that does allow refugees to work quite exceptionally. And we've been able to see that there are huge benefits not only for the refugee community, but also the host society. So for instance, in the capital city, Kampala, 21% of refugees run a business that employs at least one other person. And of those they employ, 40% are citizens of the host country. So in other words, refugees are making jobs.
That's not a bad percentage, is it? I mean, I thought you were going to say 40% are other refugees who are acquiring skills, but 40% are local people, because you would have thought that they could get a job somewhere else anyway. So if they can provide a work for the locals, that's good. But would that be the case in Germany, for example, where you've got such a high-skilled country that's already shifting lower-skilled parts of the manufacturing process to another place? Mm. Countries, shock horror, might have to try and work together to say, well, in our end product, we want a refugee contribution, but it's not going to be in this country simply because we're too high tech.
Economic integration for refugees is much harder when you get to the rich world, because if you imagine being a Syrian refugee, you're leaving a $2,000 GDP a year economy and moving to a $40,000 a year economy.
It's different, isn't it?
And so there's a productivity gap, and it means that refugees don't always have the skills to be competitive in those labour markets. So Germany took 500,000 Syrians in 2015 and 16. The majority are still unemployed, and the reasons for that are obvious. What it's going to require for a country like Germany, and this extends to Australia, is huge upfront investment in retraining, reskilling, giving people the skills to contribute. And we've seen in the data that's available in Australia, for instance, that refugees tend to be able to contribute economically, but usually it takes time. Often it is delayed till the second generation because of the investment needed in language training, qualifications acquisition. It requires a lot of investment upfront, whereas in developed countries, there's much more economic parity, and so it's much easier for refugees to insert straight into those economies if the jobs and investment are there.
Now, David Cameron had a plan. He went over to one of the camps, I think, in Jordan. And as is the case with public opinion, it can be touched by the photograph on a photograph on the front page of a paper. And was, remember, that young boy, I think, was found drowned on a beach, and a youngish man was picked him up. And that was a very emotive photo. Good thing, because it went around the world and sparked people's enthusiasm, if you want to call it that, for this issue again. And then Cameron had an idea. What happened with that?
Well, when the images of Alan Kurdi went viral, David Cameron immediately organised a visit to Lebanon and Jordan. And just prior to that visit, I'd been in Jordan with a colleague, Sir Paul Collier, a development economist. And we'd been at the now famous Zaatari refugee camp. Mm-hmm. But we'd found that just 15 minutes away was a special economic zone, which the government had spent millions of dollars connecting to the electricity grid and the road network. But it lacked access to labour and it lacked access to investment. So we put on the table the idea of, why don't we allow the 83,000 refugees 15 minutes up the road who can't work to work alongside Jordanians, and get the European Union to provide trade concessions, get the World Bank to provide investment. And when David Cameron visited, he spoke to King Abdullah. We'd spoken to the royal family while there. Abdullah put the proposal on the table. Cameron picked it up, took it to a conference in London in February 2016. The donors backed it, and it's taken off. It's become known as the Jordan Compact, allowing Syrians to work alongside Jordanians in 18 special economic zones in Jordan.
That's in practice now.
It's in practice. So the commitment was made by Jordan, previously didn't allow refugees to work, to provide work permits to 200,000 Syrians.
Gee.
I travelled back to Jordan.
And that's helped them out. That's a two-way win.
It's been great for Jordan because it's allowed them as a middle-income country to make the leap to manufacturing. It's great for refugees because it allows them to work. It's great for Europe because it creates a sustainable base of sanctuary in the region. It's potentially great for Syria because ultimately people can return with skills and rebuild. I revisited Jordan a few weeks ago to check on progress, and they've so far given about 50,000 work permits to Syrians, taking many out of the informal sector, giving them access to labour rights, including minimum wage and right to leave, including maternity leave. And there are factories that I've seen in the economic zones that are run by Syrians, employing Syrian refugees and Jordanians. It's not perfect. Creating 200,000 jobs is a very hard thing to do in an economy with only 2.5% growth, but it's a start. Multinationals like Walmart and IKEA are doing supply chain through the economic zones, and it's an innovative model from which we can learn.
When you say it's not perfect, this is an out-of-the-blue question, perhaps not your field, but you know, you're a professor at Oxford, so you're expected to know everything. Why is it that so many people who aren't stupid, you know, they're not plugged dumb, nonetheless say, what's the answer? As if to so many of life's complex problems, there is an answer, which sort of means that for centuries before, people have been so stupid they haven't figured it out, or that this person is so stupid that they think there is an answer, when really my own experience is that there's a contribution to making things better. It's a progressive piece-by-piece change. Sometimes you have bigger breakthroughs than others. But why do people do that? What's the magic bullet? Why do they ask that silly question?
I think people want the magic bullet. They want the absolute solution.
I'd love it.
And in most areas in life like this, particularly public policy questions, the answers are complex. Mm. They require a multi-pronged response. And we don't have the answer, but I think we have one element, which is to say...
A pretty big element for the camps you're talking about.
Well, I think it is, because if we recognise just 10 countries around the world, all in developing regions, host 60% of the world's refugees, if we can create jobs and educational opportunities there and allow refugees and hosts to mutually benefit, that's a big part of the solution. It doesn't solve everything, but it may reduce the reasons why many people move onwards and embark on dangerous journeys with smugglers. It may help people achieve autonomy and dignity and contribute to rebuilding the countries of origin. So I think this is a complex area. There are trade-offs. There are conflicts of interest. Host societies around the world are justifiably concerned with the security implications, the implications for development of hosting large numbers. If we in the rich world can invest in creating development opportunities in those host countries that benefit the host societies and refugees alongside one another, then there's a chance that that will benefit everybody, that it will alleviate the need for people to move onwards, embarking on dangerous journeys. It will create opportunities for people to return home with skills, and it can make the whole system work far better.
So are you saying there that countries who aren't in those regions and don't have the camps with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, can contribute in part by what directly investing in foreign aid? Well, giving, it's not investing, it's just giving. Or are you suggesting they can contribute more by saying, well, if you can show us products that come out of this, in this case, the economic zone, that we know have got a refugee input in them, we'll buy them?
It's many of those things. So I don't think it has to be more money over the long term. It's using resources in a smarter way. So rather than pouring huge amounts of humanitarian aid indefinitely into running camps, why aren't we seeding economic opportunity? Why aren't we leveraging opportunities for our businesses, our multinational corporations, to go there to create jobs, creating the environment, the infrastructure to allow that, so that over time, refugees help themselves? That's really the challenge, saying humanitarian aid leads to dependency over the long term. Let's have a graduation.
It's not good for anybody. It's not good for the payer of the aid or the recipient.
That's exactly right. So it's moving gradually to a different model. And a key part of this is not just government doing everything. It's involving the business sector, helping multinational corporations create employment opportunities, invest in those economies and societies. And the knock-on benefit is that with those sustainable opportunities, there's less likelihood that people have to move onwards. So you gradually start to build greater political trust from electorates in the overall global system.
We use the term in Australia, aid for trade. And it's meant to convey the necessity to get the business sector involved in a variety of ways. It doesn't cost them sometimes anything, if a bit, not much, but the rewards back to them are quite good and obviously very good to the country involved. So let me give you an example. If our Foreign Affairs Department was going to run a training course for something. They might contact one of the companies that is an Australian investor in that country, and they might say, well, we need some people trained, get someone, another business in. And then all of a sudden you've got a big training course that's cheaper for everybody and better for everyone involved. So it's a really neat idea.
Globalization creates opportunities to look at refugee assistance quite differently. So if we can be really innovative, there are businesses and skills in many of the camps and settlements around the world, and they're just like markets. And as you say, one of those options is that if we identify artisans producing products, can we create the means for them to export their products so they can be sold on the high street through retail stores in all kinds of countries and cities around the world? Those kinds of opportunities mean that now we can create footloose, mobile businesses that can potentially move with refugees when they go home, but with a wider export market. So we can create new opportunities there. Education is another example. We can create internet-based platforms, forms of mobile educational opportunity that use ICT in ways that create opportunities for people even in the remote areas. And we can use globalization as a way to empower people rather than just have these arid, isolated economies or camps where we insist that it's about delivery of food, shelter, and very little more.
The warehouses.
Yeah.
Professor Betts, I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Professor Alexander Betts. He's Professor of Forced Migration and International Affairs at the University of Oxford.